Shooting Sports Foundation against New Jersey. Mr. Rowan.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Matthew Rowan on behalf of NSSF. I'm going to endeavor to save 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you. This case has a somewhat tortuous history, but the issues now on appeal are straightforward. In light of the Attorney General's concession in his brief that the Younger Doctrine cannot apply to preclude NSSF from...
Counsel, can I ask you to speak up just a little bit?
Sure. So in light of the Attorney General's concession in his brief that the Younger Doctrine cannot apply to bar NSSF from asserting its federal constitutional claims in federal court on behalf of its members other than Glock, the single question this court needs to answer on appeal is whether NSSF has standing to sue in federal court on behalf of its members other than Glock.
Now, the case becomes easy if Glock stays as a member, but you're saying, you're disclaiming that we should consider them in this, for the purposes of what you're arguing today, right?
Well, so I think it's even easier than that. I mean, so that's true. So we took what we think is the federalism-preserving step of saying, look, we're a trade association suing on behalf of 10,000-plus members who have a disparate set of injuries that arise from this statute. And while, you know, we take issue with the sort of genesis of the Glock litigation, because we don't think it was ongoing at the time that this litigation was initiated, because of course it wasn't, we made the decision, look, we're just going to take that off the table. We are going to make clear that we're not asking for any relief that would enjoin, interrupt, or intercede that lawsuit. And we did so specifically to sort of take Younger off the table. The district court sort of refused to allow us to take that off the table, but it did so in a way that I read my friend's brief to agree with us was legally erroneous. And of course that's correct, because if we were here on behalf of just those entities who had submitted declarations in support of our standing, there would be no question about Younger abstention. And so I think that's why my friend on the other side at page 45 of their brief sort of admits forthrightly that neither Younger nor Brillhart-Wilton, which they make clear at page 55, can operate to bar NSSF from suing in federal court on behalf of its other members, provided that it has standing on behalf of its other members. And on that question, there's just no reasonable debate. And so we have standing here on behalf of four discrete groups of members. None of them is Glock. And so I just want to tick through them. So the first group of members are retailers in New Jersey who have already spent time and money coming into the Attorney General's view of what is required to comply with this statute. And so we know what the Attorney General thinks is required to comply with the statute, not because the statute says it, of course it doesn't, but because the Attorney General entered into a consent decree with a defendant named Point Blank, and this is at page...
And their concerns are what? They don't want to give the notices that the state is requiring?
It's not about notices, Your Honor. So the prior practice in the industry was, if you're an individual who wants to buy a handgun magazine or rifle ammunition, all you have to do is prove that you're an adult. And in some circumstances, you don't even need to do that. There was no concrete prohibition as there is for handgun ammunition or handguns. And of course, the FBI won't perform a background check for any purchase other than a firearm. The state actually admits that that was the state of play at paragraph 16 of the Point Blank complaint that's in the joint appendix, and paragraph 17 of the Butch's complaint that's in the joint appendix. And what the Attorney General said at pages 684, 685 of the joint appendix is, here's what you need to do as an FFL to come into compliance with this new reasonable controls provision. You need to confirm that the purchaser is not a prohibited person by checking these certain forms of ID for transactions that are not covered by any pre-existing statute or regulation. And we have four members, including Little Bob's Sport Shop down in Glassboro, and that's JA 314 to 315, They said, okay, this is what's now required. They say, I've spent time and money training my employees to comply with the requirements that the Attorney General has told us this statute demands of us. the, you know, Bob Sport Shop said that led them to lose 100 sales between January and April 2025. And more sales that they don't know about, people, you know, that didn't complete them. So, and they spent time and money training their employees to follow these practices. So that's classic Article 3 standing. They're not the only one that fits that bill. We have a declaration at JA221 from Legacy Indoor Range, JA272 from Woodland Park Range 2, and JA250 from Shooters Hardware, all of whom said the same thing. They said, okay, we saw what the Attorney General now says is required. It's not clear on the face of the statute, but it's clear based on this consent decree. And so we're going to spend the time and money to come into compliance. That's classic injury, and that's separate and apart from the Susan B. Anthony standard.
So the page 45 you're referring to is the Scylla and Charybdis line, that if you want the benefits of the enforcement action against Glock, then you're trapped. And you're saying, fine, we'll carve Glock out. Is that your point?
Sure, right. We're happy, you know. We've been very clear all along that, you know, maybe Glock, and this is sort of the arguments of the back half of our brief, like maybe Glock could actually come into federal court and say, as long as we're not seeking to enjoin Glock's own suit, then like we want a parallel civil enforcement, you know, civil action in federal court. But we've said, like, we're just going to make this easy for the federal courts that, you know, we're just going to say for purposes of that litigation, we're taking off the table any sort of relief that would operate directly against it. So the sort of concerns with Younger are just gone. And the sort of same is true of Brillhart-Wilton. And I think my friends on the other side agree with that.
When you say operate directly against it, I mean, federal courts can do things that affect state litigation.
Sure.
Right? Without it causing a Younger problem.
Correct.
So that's where you're going.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, as this court made clear in Marks, in a case that the Attorney General doesn't cite in their brief, that sort of the normal collateral consequences aren't enough for Younger. And so what we were making clear is we're not asking for an injunction that would stop that litigation.
Right.
Even though we think we probably could, for the reasons we made clear, we don't think it's a quasi-civil enforcement action, we don't think it was ongoing, we think there is bad faith in all of that. But we sort of wanted to take that off the table, and yet the district court sort of anyway said, I don't think this works. But the district court did that based on just a fundamental misunderstanding that I think the state is somewhat perpetuating here, that our standing here is somehow based on Glock.
Okay, it's what not, were the other, I think, so you did New Jersey retailers, what were the other three?
So the other three, so we have a group of manufacturers, including some of Glock's largest competitors, who have come forward and said that what they sort of want to do is they want to continue selling firearms in other states that are lawful in the states, that are unlawful in New Jersey, and they have reasonable fear in light of the Attorney General's lawsuit against JSD Eagle, which was the one in Pennsylvania where it was sales of firearm kits in Pennsylvania, and of course against Glock 2, and they say based on those, we have reasonable fear that, you know, we're going to be sort of tagged with liability under this lawsuit. The Attorney General notably hasn't said that he won't enforce it against him. We also have those
other than the enforcement actions that have been brought since the prior case that Judge Bibas authored, is that the big thing that now, because there have been some enforcement actions, or I guess six, that fear is now enhanced? Is that what you're saying?
So I think there are a few differences between where we were the last time around and where we are now. So Judge Bibas's opinion identified sort of three deficiencies that with our initial for standing. So he said first, it said NSSF's intent to act is too general. At that point, we just had two declarations from members who essentially said, we want to continue to engage in lawful commerce in arms. We're worried that this statute will be used to tag liability, but they didn't say anything more than that. We now have nearly 20 declarations making very clear, here is the conduct we want to engage in. I'm happy to sort of get to the other two, but very quickly, those who sell and market Glocks in New Jersey and those who manufacture, sell, and distribute, including in New Jersey, but also elsewhere, similarly designed handguns that, although the Attorney General says are different, his own complaint against Glock makes clear that the physics of striker fire firearms, in his words, naturally lend themselves to automatic warrants. So that's one. They said our intent to act was too general then. We've now made very clear exactly what the members want to engage in. And two, he said it was murky, that was Judge Bibas's word, whether the foundation's intended conduct is arguably forbidden. Well, that's not even questionable anymore because attorney, you know, for the retailers, for instance, told us what is required. They said, we didn't used to do that. We're now going to spend money doing it. That's classic injury. For the rest, it's also like at least arguably that their continued conduct is similar, which is all that is required to those lawsuits that have already been filed. And the third was that Judge Bevis and the court found that the threat wasn't substantial, in large part because the Attorney General had not brought any enforcement actions at that point, and the Attorney General disavowed bringing suits against quote-unquote lawful commerce.
So don't you think you have to read all three in connection? That really it wasn't the insufficiency, the number of complaints that were brought, the two, but it was the two in light of the representations and in light of the actions, and we now have greater clarity on what really was to occur.
So I think that's exactly right, but whether you think about it sort of as unified whole or each one, it doesn't matter here because all three of those things are very different now, and they're very clear that we have standing. There's already been injury in fact with respect to the retailers that is directly traceable. There's clearly sort of a substantial threat of enforcement. I mean, gosh, since we reopened this lawsuit, they have initiated another enforcement action against an NSSF member, bringing, in their words, a marketing claim. And so the idea that the threat of enforcement for our other members is not substantial, I just think is belied by reality. And I think that's why, you know, they try to squeeze out of
it. I guess the first case is, was it, when is it substantial enough? You're writing this opinion. When do you cross the line?
So I think two different sets, right? So we have first those who have already suffered injury, right? So they clearly have standing, which means NSSF clearly has standing. So you don't really need to get to the rest of them. But, you know, I think what you would say is, look, in a context where the regulated entities are, you know, directly regulated by this statute, and they have said exactly what conduct in which they want to engage, and that conduct is arguably prescribed, and that conduct is at least arguably affected with a constitutional interest, which my friend has never disputed, and there have been a number of enforcement actions based on similar conduct against similar parties, and the state has not disavowed enforcing it against them, that's enough. Because otherwise, you really do leave regulated entities sort of in this trap. And it's almost worse than the preclusion trap that Judge Mady talked about in the Smith and Wesson case. Because here, I mean, Judge Qureshi, you know, he ended up issuing this Younger opinion, which I think both degrees incorrect. He recognized in granting reopening, and this is at Joint Appendix 108, that we really suffer sort of extraordinary circumstances here, given that at least one factor motivating the Third Circuit's opinion last time around was the state's representation of sort of what its intent was or wasn't. And, you know, we obviously have a dispute about how best to read that representation, but I do think that sort of given where we are now, there's just no dispute that this case should proceed to the merits.
So New Jersey argued that a state court defendant can evade Younger by just joining an association and having it bring the federal lawsuit. How do you respond to that?
So I think there are sort of two different ways to answer that. I mean, one is that no, if what they're asking for in the federal lawsuit is relief that would operate against the state lawsuit, no, then it doesn't matter. I mean, right. So that's like the Eighth Circuit decisions on which Judge Qureshi relied, right? So there's Cedar Rapids, right? It was like the corporate sort of partner. But of course, that case is relevant too because the second holding of that case is that parties that did not sort of share corporate personhood were not subject to Younger, even though they had the same general interest. And of course, NSSF has the same general interest. And I mean, the second answer is, you know, I think there's no, like, you sort of look at beginnings when you're dealing with Younger. And if a company sort of joins a trade association after the fact, I think you're gonna have a very different sort of analysis than what you have here. And I think it's important just to take a step back because this case has never been about Glock. I mean, when Glock has never filed a declaration in any version of this case. And my friend on the other side sort of says, well, you have these like four as applied theories. One of them is about we have five constitutional claims. Our bases of standing, we have sort of four different bases of standing, none of which is Glock. And our claims sort of have, you know, some of them are purely facial, some are facial and facial and as applied. But, you know, it's important to sort of keep the merits and standing separate. And, you know, we clearly have standing, and I see I'm into my rebuttal time, so we'll come back.
Okay,
in a few minutes.
You.
Thank you.
Mr. Sheehan.
May it please the court, Tim Sheehan for appellee. The dispute before this court involves two narrow questions. First, we agree that NSSF's challenge to the Glock suit specifically is the only claim that could face a Younger bar, and NSSF barely disputes that Younger does block its attempt to enjoin the pending suit against Glock, and even seems to disavow it. This court should thus affirm the Younger holding as to the Glock suit. But second, as for the remaining claims, this court should affirm on the ground that these other NSSF members simply fail to satisfy Article 3, or at worst, if to the extent this court thinks it's unclear whether the district court reached that issue, to remand to the district court to decide that question in the first instance. I welcome the court's questions at any time. I do want to just pick up on this Younger question, and was there actually an attempt to intercede with the Glock suit? So I do agree with Judge Porter, the thrust of your question, that if a state court defendant just joins a trade association and that association launches a collateral attack on its behalf, that's Younger barred. I don't think anyone is disputing that. I guess
on our facts, did that happen here?
We do think it happened, and I think the only disagreement we have here is whether they sought to intercede with the Glock suit. So I hear them now saying we want to carve that out of this case. I don't think that's quite what they said to the district court. To be sure,
Were Butches and Point Blank and these other, were they already NSF members, or did they join after you guys sued them?
Those other members are not members of NSSF as far as we know. They haven't claimed them as members. Of course, there's no public membership list, so we have to go on the representation.
Of these five non-Glock enforcement actions you have brought, only Glock obviously is a member, but the other five are not members?
As far as we know, yes.
And do you disavow any intent to sue Glock sellers who happen to be members of the Sports Federation?
So I think we did address this in our brief. The best place is page 59, where we did say that there is no substantial threat of enforcement against retailers who, quote, simply put Glocks on their shelves. But to put this totally to rest, we are categorically disclaiming enforcement against sellers who do nothing more than put Glocks on their store shelves. So, I do want to explain why we also think that conduct is not even arguably prescribed under our statute, and it helps to understand why Glock's conduct violates our statute. So as we alleged, Glock's conduct is egregious. It knowingly designed a handgun to make one single part responsible for inhibiting automatic fire, and it made that one part easily suppressed from the outside. It knew this invited use as a machine gun, and even itself demonstrated that capability to government officials, and it maintained this design after it learned of mounting public harm from switched Glocks in New Jersey. That clears the relatively high pleading bar for the claims we brought in the Glock suit, including aiding and abetting, which after the Smith & Wesson decision requires kind of a specific intent to bring about the result of machine gun possession and creation. Someone who just puts Glocks on the store shelves, we don't see how those same claims work against someone who that's their only conduct, is that they sell Glocks. So that is why we've disavowed enforcement as to that sort of bare bones description of conduct.
What if they want to advertise that they have Glock firearms for sale?
I don't think that's any different, whether you're selling Glocks or you know, advertising the fact that
and
you sell Glocks.
You're not going to go after them, even if they market, is that correct?
If they are just marketing the fact that they sell the Glock pistol, we don't think that is any different. I do want to be clear, Your Honor. I can imagine hypos where someone who sells Glocks and also does other egregious conduct.
Well, now we seem to be getting into it, though, counsel. I mean, you've now just carved out an entire exception from your disclaimer, which strikes me as similar to your representation that no one was going to be charged if all they were doing is engaging in lawful commerce. And it turned out there was a whole lot of exceptions to that representation, too. So how are we to make any of this other than we're back where we started from? It's a law that is going to be enforced as the Attorney General sees fit against any number of sellers who are engaging in the very conduct that Butches and Point Blank are engaged in, and we'll wait to find out what those actions are. And isn't that the whole point of a pre-enforcement challenge? So we don't have to wait to see if there's violations of the First Amendment, Second Amendment, et cetera?
So, Your Honor, I want to explain the scope of this carve-out and address your broader point about representations on enforcement intentions. So on the Glocks sellers, I just want to clarify, you can imagine different hypos where it is someone who sells Glocks, but their conduct is a little more egregious. If they want to sell the G17 pistol, but also put a poster next to it that explains to customers how you can use a sear to switch it and enable machine gun capability, we think that is materially different from the mere conduct of selling Glocks. That is a lot more like Glock's own conduct, and we think that would be prescribed conduct and faces a credible threat of enforcement. I think the conduct is just materially different within the frame of the liability claims that we brought in the Glock suit. That's why we are not disavowing that category of conduct. We're just saying that the fact pattern that was put before this court is the mere fact that sellers sell Glocks. We think that is different. We don't think that's prescribed. I want to come to Your Honor's broader point about the enforcement representation. So to be clear, we did not represent to this court that we would only bring claims alleging independently unlawful conduct under Section A1 of our statute. Instead, what we said is we pledged no actions that are based solely on lawful firearms commerce, specifically the kind of strict liability style lawsuits that predated PLCA, where you sell a lot of guns, a criminal did a bad thing, therefore you're on the hook for all the downstream harm. At the same time, we
Where was that specific part that you mentioned?
Sure, that is JA377 and JA393, that's the Third Circuit transcript. At the same time, we also made clear that we would bring actions under all three prongs of our statute when warranted. We stressed that an entity can be liable for its own culpable misconduct, which means, quote, either violating the law or doing something that is a tort, unquote. That is also JA377. And we gave an example of conduct that might, quote, check the boxes on the law, but it certainly seems unreasonable, unquote. And so we could bring an action under Section A1's unreasonableness prong. That's JA444. So the only kind of action that we disclaimed is the strict liability style lawsuit. And none of the suits that we brought look anything like that specific category. In four of the actions that we brought, including Glock itself, we allege that the entity's own conduct violates independent state statutes. Two others allege violations of our reasonable controls requirement in Section A2, and those are again for that entity's own conduct, and those two cases don't even involve downstream harm. Those were called by, so it's just a point of sale violation. So we don't think there's anything to this notion that we then brought actions that we had specifically disclaimed to this court. We disclaimed a very specific category to this court, and some of the actions we brought look like that.
Let me work backwards, picking up on Judge Mady's question. You've got a statute here that in 35A states that a gun industry member shall not by conduct, quote, unlawful in itself, knowingly, recklessly create, maintain, or contribute to a public nuisance. That's pretty general. And then in A2 talks about forbids gun industry members from recklessly creating a public nuisance through conduct unreasonable under all the circumstances. So that's really it's about as expansive as one can get. And so you're out there and you're a member of the Sports Federation. You're going, I have no idea what this means. I'd like to have this reviewed by a court. And you're saying, but you don't have the standing to come into court. And I'm going to ask you the same question I asked the other side. When is the line crossed that there is standing versus no standing?
Yes. So to be clear, Your Honor, we can easily see hypos where you do cross the line into Article III standing. I just gave this court the example of someone who sells Glocks but also promotes the switchability. On the point blank fact pattern that my friend on the other side mentioned, we can imagine, I think the problem with that fact pattern is actually the declarants are not alleging the conduct in the way that their counsel is sort of characterizing it. The declarations actually said that those members have changed their practices to come into compliance with our statute by doing basic ID checks for ammunition sales, and that there's no allegation of an intent to revert to a different practice where they don't do any checks whatsoever for ammunition sales. If you did have a member who said, we would like to do no checks whatsoever for any ammunition sales, that is prescribed conduct. That is just the point blank lawsuit. So we would have no issue on Article 3 grounds with that. We would just litigate the merits of that.
Now you're picking and choosing, but you're writing the opinion. When do you cross the line? When don't you?
So I think those are the two examples. I mean, just to be clear, like, we acknowledge that you can bring fact patterns that satisfy Article 3. We are responding to the three fact patterns they put before this court. One is the point blank fact pattern. The other two are these parties that they think are similar to Glock. So just using these three categories, we think that the three fact patterns they put before the court don't satisfy Article 3 because what they're relying on is the conduct in the Glock lawsuit or the conduct charge in the point blank lawsuit. And they simply are not engaging in alleging an intent to engage in the same or similar conduct because the conduct they're alleging is materially different.
Is your answer that you would essentially write an opinion similar to what was done in the prior case in 2023 or 2024, I guess?
I think those three fact patterns do kind of run into the same issue where the description of the conduct is just too vague that it and just is too bare bones, really, to a thing that is arguably prescribed. So I think the way this court could write the opinion, obviously, we think you should affirm the Younger holding as
but,
to the
But if you're on the other side, vague is a very important word because you look at the statute and you're going, I don't know if it belongs to me. And I'd like to find out.
Sure. And I think that is what the issue was in NSSF 1. And what this said was that makes this statute less susceptible to pre-enforcement review, not more. When it's a standard of care, that doesn't make it more amenable to pre-enforcement review, especially when it's a statute that is exclusively enforceable by the Attorney General. But I do want to be clear, like, they can come back to the district court with a new PI motion, different facts, different declarants, and there's no reason they can't do that. Nothing in this court's opinion needs to close the door to that. Our point is simply that the three fact patterns that they put before this court do not clear that bar because they are relying on drawing these analogies to two other lawsuits.
But when is there a fact pattern, in this case hypothetical, from your perspective, that would cross the line to their being standing?
I can give you three specific examples. So in the point blank hypo.
I'm just speaking. When is there, I mean, we're trying to come up with a theme as to when you have standing, when you don't. You're saying, you keep coming back to point blank and Butch and saying, well, they don't, but when do you? What would you have to do to have standing?
So to take this court's prior opinion, they have to allege an intent to engage in conduct that is arguably prescribed by our statute for which a credible.
But they're saying, I don't even know what the statute says. I mean, it's so broad.
Right, and this goes back to the problems with the first hearing where the colloquy you keep relying on is the court asking, well, what do you mean by lawful commerce? Are you accepting, and you says, well, we're saying it's fine if it doesn't violate this law or other law. And the court says, yeah, I'm kind of confused what we're doing here. I mean, if you're talking about things like straw purchasers and record keeping, and the office says, yes, that's exactly what we're talking about, but we don't understand why we're here either. But the problem is what you really meant was anything that we think violates this statute, which could be a whole host of hypotheticals, can in fact and will be charged. And that's what the plaintiff said last time and reiterate now, saying, well, now we know what they're going to do. They're going to pick certain conduct which doesn't fall under federal prohibitions. We're not talking about the FFL registrations. We're talking about new conduct that the state has considered to be impermissible. How are they supposed to know what's going to fall in and what isn't other than to just keep doing what they're allowed to do under federal law and hope that subpoenas and charges don't come?
So, Your Honor, I see my time is running out. If I can just answer that question. I do think this court does not need to chart the outer boundaries of this statute and when it can be violated and not violated. This court is just,
how about just the minimal boundaries? I mean, I think that's what we're struggling with. It's not the outer boundaries. It's what's going to be within. It seems as though it's entirely at your discretion.
So I think that the minimum boundaries are, there are three causes of action in our statute. The first is conduct that violates separate statutes. So that is a pretty clear marker if there is a separate state or federal statute that's being violated, as was the case in four of the cases that we've brought. That is one cause of action. The second cause of action is our own, is the reasonable controls requirement in the statute. The reasonable controls are defined. There are four specific prongs. So I think every industry is on notice that these are the four specific kinds of controls you need to maintain, and they can just look at those controls and decide whether they're alleging they're in compliance with that or not. The third is conduct that is unreasonable. And if you look at the four lawsuits where there's even an unreasonableness count, it's based on the same conduct that establishes independent statutory violations. So I think, again, to come back to the three fact patterns that are before this court, there are certainly versions of these fact patterns that they can allege that cross the line into prescribed conduct that faces a credible threat of enforcement. There's the point blank fact pattern if they actually allege that they wish to do no checks whatsoever for ammunition sales. That's prescribed conduct. That's just the facts of point blank. If you are a seller of Glocks that also wants to take extra steps to promote the machine gun capability to your customers, that's prescribed conduct.
What would that be, just so I understand?
Well, extra steps to promote machine gun capacity?
Yeah, sure.
What's a machine gun, first of all, so I understand?
A machine gun, what we allege in the Glock suit is that there is one part within the internal mechanism that blocks automatic fire, and you can put in a little sear or a switch through the outside that inhibits that one piece, and by doing so, it allows automatic fire by just a single pull of the trigger. So that's what makes it a machine gun in the Glock.
So what would be promoting that?
So if you are a retailer and you have the G17 on your store shelves, but you also have a poster next to it or at the register, you explain to your customers, I want you to know that you can also use this gun as a machine gun. All you have to do is get this switch. They're easy to get. You just put
what if the poster says the Glock 17, the most adaptable firearm in the industry?
I think that's a closer case. I'm
okay. So that's the problem, is we're getting into like a lot of line drawing here where it seems like something innocuous like that might well still with be in the statute's ambit. I understand the plaintiffs to be saying, well, that's how we're not sure what we can do. It's not a matter of looking at the controls and saying, we know what it is we're not allowed to do. We have to make a decision about it. It's, we're not entirely sure what's going to fall in or without. And it seems like that's why you need the pre-enforcement challenge, right?
Sure. And Your Honor, I can spot you the poster that says the most adaptable firearm. Our point is simply, you don't even have that here. You have just the fact that they sell Glocks, and that is just not enough to cross the line under any of the claims of theories of liability in the Glock lawsuit, which are things like aiding and abetting machine gun possession, proximately causing the creation of machine guns. I don't hear any dispute from the other side that if all you do is put Glocks on the shelves, you've crossed that line from general awareness into a specific intent to facilitate machine gun creation. So if they're relying on the Glock lawsuit itself, the line between is it prescribed or not prescribed, it comes from the theories of liability in Glock, and you can just look at those claims. And we've been very clear that if all you do is sell the G17 pistol, that is not prescribed, and we are disavowing enforcement against someone who does no more than that. I see my time has expired.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
So I think I can bring some clarity to the confusion. So first, we have members who essentially are plaintiffs for these purposes who have spent money and lost sales as a result of coming into compliance. Those are the declarations at 314 to 315, JA 221 to 228. JA 272 to 79, and JA 250 to 257. They all plainly have standing. My friend on the other side actually said, if you want to do the specific kinds of controls that we now only know because of the consent decree, then you'd have standing. That's what they have attested to have done. They are not relying on the threat of a future enforcement action. They're relying on the fact that they've already spent time and money and lost sales. With respect to manufacturers of so-called Glock clones, the Attorney General also notably did not disavow enforcement against them, and we have declarations from them. We cited them in our briefs. You can look to the declarations. They all make very clear. We're very worried because, of course, the switchability on which the Glock lawsuit depends is well known, and we're very worried that the Attorney General, just as they did with respect to the suit against Sig Sauer, Judge Amber, you asked, they are an NSSF member. So after we reopened this lawsuit, the Attorney General initiated another enforcement action against an NSSF member. This is not hypothetical. The one thing they—
Who was that member?
Sig Sauer.
Yeah.
Makes the B320. I mean, so, and, you know, so they haven't disavowed against the conduct in which our members say they are engaged in, which is manufacturing firearms in other states that are lawful there, including, for instance, the AR-15, which the Attorney General has stood up in this court and said is sufficiently akin to a machine gun that can be banned. And I know you have a case on that at the en banc level, but the idea that they're going to not, you know, use this statute sort of as the sword of Damocles, I think just sort of gets everything backwards. And I mean, I think to your point, Judge Mady, like, they really do sort of have the industry in a bind.
What's the theory of the Sig Sauer enforcement action?
So it's allegedly a defect that it fires when not pulled the trigger, but they also have like marketing claims and the marketing
so
there.
So it's not a design issue. It's just a defect.
Design defect?
Yes. There are some other claims, but you know, there are some marketing claims in there, and like the marketing allegations there are not like, hey, this won't happen. I mean, you know, it's sort of similar to what you were talking about. I mean, the adaptability. These are sort of general phrases that are very common in this industry that could get sort of an individual or a company like right in the crosshairs of this statute. And I mean, you know, we've been at this now for 4 years, and all we want is an opportunity to raise the constitutional challenges in federal court, and Section 1983 guarantees us that. We plainly have standing, and we look forward on remand to being able to challenge this law. Thank you, Your Honors.